Mr. Rogers, Reel 7. Now, we're talking about the Channel crossing the night of the 5th of June. You'd set off in at 17:45. And as you were going, one of the seamen was washed overboard. And you were saying what you were wearing. And you'd got to... I think you were just about to say you got a steel helmet as well.
Yeah, they had the steel helmets on. And, because I flung that off, because they're more trouble than they're worth if you're in the water. And I grabbed hold of him and hung on to him because they shouted out, stop engines.
You didn't follow him overboard, you just threw him a line?
No, I went in the water hanging on to a line. And, what's call it? They, a couple of them come up and started trying to get hold of him. Because 3 foot out, though he was only 3 foot out of the water, it's a long way when you've got to try and pull someone up. So I'm trying to...
Couldn't he help himself?
He was so terrified, see? And don't forget, he's got a duffel coat on, see, in that. And the sea boots come right away out there, all
right
leather.
The
see, and big thick stockings. And I'm trying to push him up from his backside. They got him on board. And that's when must have been the second class stoker, came up to help. And as he was pulling him up, his feet went from underneath him, and he went in. So I had to grab hold of him. Well, they went down, and we got underway, and then we was on our own. And what's called
it? So you'd fallen behind?
We'd fallen behind. And as well, we thought we'd fallen behind. We'd been carrying on, must have been for a couple of hours, and all of a sudden, ahoy there, it was one of the barges being towed by one of the tugs. His engines had broken down. So they asked us if we would take him alongside. So our coxswain says, what you carrying? He said, ammunition. He said, no way. He said, no, we won't take him in tow. Because it means that we have to take him in tow, that means you've got to be side by side. See, left side by side. So he said, no way. And then we realised we just followed the tug leading boat, sort of. And it broke dawn. And the waves were getting a bit dicey then. One minute...
What was it like?
Well, one minute, all you could see was big waves round you, like houses.
That bad?
And next minute, we could look as if we were standing on... I won't say the Empire State Building, but say Nelson's Column, looking all round Whitehall. See? But don't forget, these waves... but nothing to the other ships. See, you imagine a cork as you get in the water, say, get in the bath. See? And we followed them. We got to... we didn't know then it was Omaha Beach. And we was told politely to get out of the way because we were causing chaos, being that the hammering they were taking at Omaha Beach.
What could you see as you approached?
Just big ships. And when we made our way through, because we thought we were at the beach straight away, see? And we got stopped. And I suppose we laid off about a quarter of a mile. And there was two... the coxswain had his own binoculars and he had the naval issue... binoculars, and we could see what was going on.
What could you see?
Well, just people running along and going down and not getting up. It was just like being in a 10-pin bowling alley, and they were all knocking the pins down together. Something I'll never forget as long as I live.
You realised they were American, did you?
We knew we was really Americans because they were all flying the Stars and Stripes until a boat came up and threatened to shoot the coxswain if he didn't move. And being I was on the Lewis guns at the time, he decided to give his revolver to the coxswain, because I said if he pulls that trigger, I'll cut him and the rest of his crew over in half.
Who was this? You were just
to a one ringer in the Royal, in the American Navy. He had four men on board.
On board of what?
A cutter. And it was his attitude.
Would you have shot him, or were you just?
I would have done if he'd have pulled the trigger and they shot the coxswain. And bloke on one of the ships there, wasn't a big ship, but it was about the size of an LST. He got a loud halo and shouted down, "What's the trouble?" And I shouted up, I said, "He's trying to shoot our coxswain." And I said, "I'm going to cut him in half if he pulls the trigger." Well, he told him to lower his revolver. So I told him, to hand it to the coxswain. Because the coxswain always wanted American 45. And he did. And off they went. Then this naval officer was on this landing craft, had all scrambled eggs round his hat. He asked us to move politely, as we're causing chaos because we're so low in the water that they can't see us until they're near up on top of us. And they said, "Will we go down to the other beach?"
So that's further to the north or the south?
South, down towards the, where the British was. So we went down to Utah Beach. And we didn't wait, we just went straight in, because by this time it's about 4 or 5 o'clock in the evening on the 6th. And we beached there, then we had a row with a...
What do you remember of the beaching? Anything special about it?
Well,
the beaching at Utah Beach, how you did
Utah
it?
Utah Beach.
What do you remember about going in, how you felt and what happened?
Well, there was not many ships about there, and it was, I wouldn't say deserted in the sense of the word, there was a few trucks here and there, but nothing else, because that's why we went straight in and beached, and two other barges with us, and all of a sudden, military police came up, what they call snowdrops in the American Navy, with a rum ringer in the American Navy. "You can't beach there, we've got no. Then a 2.5 ringer came up. "What's the trouble?" So I told him. He said, "What you got on there?" I said, "Well, send him," meaning the snowdrop, "go and have a look," because it was my turn to put the spike into the beach. And when he went in there and he came running back, he said, "They got jerry cans of petrol." So this 2.5 ring said, "How many is there?" I said, 500. Where these trucks come from, I don't know. If they were buried in the sand or they dropped by aeroplane. But they were there unloading those jerry cans of petrol like nobody's business. They didn't half unload them. And because when it was unloaded, we had to sit there until the next high tide before we could get off the beach.
What did you do during that? Were you under fire at all on the beach?
Well, we had several, we found out afterwards what they were 88s, but we had no aircraft or anything like that. But
And what could you see on the beach? What was happening, other than the unloading of your boat? But, I mean, what else was happening? Were there any others of your flotilla beached there?
Yeah, three. There was two other barges. They make three of us, and they were unloaded. But once you get your iron dry, your job is not finished. You've got to go down and dig like a trench, put it that way, under the landing craft. You don't get it because it's flat bottom.
Under the barge?
Yeah, right the way round it. So when the tide comes in, the water would go down into these trenches or tunnels, whatever you like to call them, and help to raise the barge because the suction from the sand wouldn't release them. And that's what we had to do.
That sounds like hard work.
It was hard work, you take it from me. But we're not too bad because Skipper Osborne came along in his cutter and he said, "Here, catch hold." And he flung us a jar that big.
Of what?
Ship's rum. Where he got it from, I don't know. So we had some of that, and after we had a couple of those, you pick the barge up and take it out to sea.
How drunk did you get?
Well, our coxswain, he wasn't a foolish man. He'd known we'd had enough, and that's when it stopped. See? He wouldn't let anybody get drunk.
So it was just enough to liven you up?
Yeah. To keep us going. And when the tide came in, after, you know, we got rid of the first lot, we was doing ship to shore, going out to the ships that couldn't come right inland, and because Marlborough Harbour was only being used for lorries and tanks and things like that. But supplies, we had to carry them in.
Now, how did you get them off the ships?
Well, they come down by crane, right into the hole, see? And
always to Utah?
That's it. Well, Utah and Omaha. See, we got our orders from the beach party to where we had to go, see? Because different ships could only come so far inland, see? Or in to the walls of shore. And we had to go and...
How long were you doing that for?
Well, up until the 19th of June. That is when the spring tide blew up and with a 12-knot tide, with a 12-gale... what's it called it? 12-knot gale. And that is when we sank, because when we got there and we unloaded the... petrol, the army took the all the timbers for the hatch and used them on the beach so they could drive onto those. And the big metal thing that was bolted down the centre, they took that off so the cranes could drop everything into it. Well, when the storm blew up, the waves was tossing us. Well, sometimes we didn't know if there was a thing called gravity. It was like that, hanging on for dear life, thinking it could turn over, and the waves were coming over until the hull was filled. Then that's when we started.
How far offshore were you?
I don't know, but we had a Carly float, which was roughly 4 foot square by 12 inches thick, and there was loops all the way round it, and the seven of us hung onto those.
You didn't actually get in?
No, couldn't get in
them. It, you know.
No, it was just a flat.
You didn't get on, you just hang on to it?
Exactly, had to hang on to it.
What was it like in the water?
Not too bad, cold, but not freezing. But because it was tossing us about like a feather in the wind. And I'd, splice some rings, splice in, right, so that you could put your hand through. So, and I had them going from one side to the other, so that as soon as you got hold of the loops, you could put your hand through it. So if you got, you know, your arms got numb, and you let go, the wood round their wrist would hold them up. And what's called it? That's when we lost our landing craft, and we was picked up by the.
How long were you in the water?
10 hours, so the coxswain said. And we was picked up by the Americans, and we went to.
Do you know which boat?
In the what's called it? Amphibious truck, open truck, like a duck. Like a duck picked us up and put us in the field hospital at Utah Beach. And that's we was in there for 48 hours.
How were you? What state were you?
Well, exhausted. And we was safe. They took us in straight with this amphibious truck, whatever it was. And because... they went straight away and they put us in a big tent and on bunks, and they fed us, kept us warm, give us all the American gear to wear. And we was in there for 48 hours, and the doctor came round, asked us how we felt. We said, all right. So I said, are you fit to go out? So we said, yeah. So he said, well, I am pleased because we've got a lot of wounded coming in. And we came out of there, and...
So this would be on the... You'd be in there on the 20th, the 21st, basically.
Yeah, that something like that. And we were walking up and down the beach, me and Ronnie Skates, just the two of us, and we got so fed up, we went up, saw a load of officers, American officers, and asked them if there's something we could do to occupy us. And they looked at me, and this two and a half bringer that came when we first landed at Utah Beach, he was one of the officers. Said, your face is familiar. So I said, yes, and I told him who I was, because he took my name and that. Ah, and he said to one of the other officer said, brings up his arm, what rank he was, I don't know. And I said, have you got a job for us to do in the cookhouse, anything, you know? So there was an army officer there. He said, I'll have him. He was, we found out he was a major in the American Army. And they said, all right, you can have him. So as we left there and walking with him. He said, on the Royal Engineers, the Engineers, American Engineers, and we're clearing clearing the beaches of mines. I said, well, we don't know nothing about mines, sir. He said, no. He said, when we come to a mine, my crew will be dismantling them, but we would like someone to take the, after they've been dismantled, take them and stack them so they can be put onto a truck and blown up. And that's what we did until the 1st of July. This major come running back, don't know where he'd been, but he said, you've got to go to that LST up there, LST, landing ship tank, he said, and get aboard there, you're going back to UK. And we went on there, they took our name, rank and number. We went back to Portsmouth or Southampton, I forget now. And they issued us out with new gear. And what's called it? On the 5th of July, 1944, they sent us on 7-day survivor's leave. And...
What was that like? How did you feel? I mean, you'd had quite an experience there, 10 hours in the water. How did you feel when you got on your survivor's leave?
Only too glad to get home, you know.
You just came back to London.
I came back to London, and my grandmother was alive then, and she said, this has just come. Only come yesterday. It was a card they give you, you had to fill in, say that you've been admitted to hospital, but you're all right, you've not been wounded. And because my grandmother, she was nearly blind, she made me strip to the back of my pants to make sure that I was all right. And on the 12th of July, which I was supposed to go back, I wouldn't go back, because my birthday's on the 12th of July. I went back on the 13th. And because my grandmother told me off, she said, she was very strict like that, my grandmother. But otherwise, we thought the world of her. And when I got back, I had to go in front of Jimmy the One to be punished. So when he asked me why I never came back, I said, well, I had 7 days survivor's leave, sir. And it was from the 5th to the 12th. And as you look in my papers, I said that the 12th was my birthday. And I wasn't coming back from the family on my birthday. And he said to the chief petty officer that marched me in, he said, chief, take him out and get rid of him. I don't want to see him. And he's waving his hand about. So when we got outside, the chief petty officer said to me, you deserve to get away with that, he said. I don't know if that was planned, he said, but it's the best excuse I've ever heard in all my years in the Navy. So I got away with it.
And what happened next then?
Well, the next thing we know, we had to report to the Yarmouth Isle of Wight. That's where we had to go back. And then we got a draft to go to HMS Westcliff. That was at Westcliff-on-Sea, this side of Southend. It was a survivor's base. Everybody there was a survivor. And on the 24th of August, 1944, they cleared all lower decks. Chief Petty Officer come along with a petty officer. From here, right turn, by the right quick march. And they marched us right the way round to near the end of Westcliff-on-Sea to a place called Prenbu Road. And we stopped outside a great big house. It was a big house with the front door was in the middle. And when we went in, it was a big hall. It's really massive hall, and he said, line up, you've got to go in that door on the right, that is facing it from the street. So we were lined up in there, and when we went in, they had to give our rank, name and number. Yes, right, stamp this, take this paper to the next table, rank, name and number. Yeah, bump, bump, bump. Okay, what's this? Your discharge papers out of the Royal Navy. 24th of August 1944. Lovely, beautiful. Went to go out, Royal Marines there with a rifle and bayonet. No, you can't go out. Well, anyone to go smoke, you stay here. So went out to go on the other side, see the other room. Rank, name and number. Yep. Sitting up on a podium as a Commodore in the Royal Navy, sitting there, looking down at everybody, typical Navy. And, right, go over to the next table, rank, name and number, sign here. What's this? You're calling up papers for the Army. So from the time I got discharged from the Navy to the Army, was 20 minutes.
Have they asked you at all about this?
No. None of us knew whatsoever. They shanghaied us, into the army. And when I said to this commodore, I said, excuse me, sir, more my family's Royal Navy. I don't want to be a Pongo, because that was what we used to call the army. You're only HO'd. Bloody hell's HO, I don't myself. Found out afterwards, hostilities only. Well, cut a long story short, one of the Marines had his rifle at the eye port, started shoving me. So he shoved me too much and I went with him. He hit a post and I took the rifle out of his hand. It was a Lee Enfield Mark III with the 18-inch bayonet. And I put my spout, loaded rifle, put the spout right up there. His mate was looking for the safety catch on his rifle. So I had the rifle pointed between his legs. I said, carry on, and I said, I'll blow your brains off. And he put it down on the floor, and I said, you old so-and-so, and if the Olympics had been on, that commodore would have won the gold medal for the way he dived off of that podium. And the two chaps at the tables were only four-legged tables, and they dived underneath them. And to this day, I've been trying to find out why they dived underneath it. Because there's four legs. What's hiding them? Could never make it out. And of course, some more Marines come in, and when they saw me pointing the gun at them, they decided to put theirs down, because one was behind the other. I said, at this distance, if I fire this, it goes through you and the other one as well. And with that, I heard someone talking. And he come past me on the right hand side, past me. He walked right the way round in front of me, come up. He was a sergeant in the army, in the military police. I'll never forget it. I got the rifle in the hand, and he never raised his voice, shouted or nothing. He just spoke normal. But as he spoke, you could hear the authority behind what he was saying. And he said to me, now, they can't touch you, but you're in the army now, so you're under my jurisdiction. And with that, he said, get rid of that bonduk. Well, I didn't know what a bonduk was. It's the Indian word for rifle. Because when I had a closer look at him, he had up the Indian General Service Medal, Burma, 1930-32. So he must have been a well regular soldier. And when I threw the rifle down, the bayonet stuck in the wooden floor and the rifle's dangling out in the air like that. So with that, he says, get in front of me. And as I got in front of him, there was four other MPs there. And he said, watch my back. And they all drawn their revolvers out. And he marched. Made me march, and he stood, walked behind me all the way until we got outside. He said, that's a nice bit of work you've done there with that rifle. So, one thing and the other, he said, well, look, I don't want to see that effing ginger head of yours again, because if I do, your feet won't touch the floor. Now, op it, or words to that effect, and that's my time in the Navy, so I went into the Army.
Now, who were you sent to join? So you never had anything more about this. It's quite a serious incident from the sound of it, but this NCO sorted it all out.
Actually, to be truthful with you, before we marched out, this Commodore said, I want him, I'm going to have him court-martialed. So the Sergeant turned around and said, he's in the army now, and he's under my jurisdiction. I'll have you court-martialed, this Commodore said. So the sergeant turned around and said to the full corporal MP, go and get the provost marshal. In come a captain, a provost marshal. What's the matter, sergeant? So he said, I've just been threatened by the officer there, naval officer there, have a court-martial, because he wants to take over this man that's been transferred into the army.